CV18-123, Houston Independent School District versus Texas Workforce Commission. As you know, each side will be given 20 minutes to argue. I understand we reserved 5 minutes for you for rebuttal. Is that correct? Oh, for you all. Sorry. We've sat backwards this morning. As you know, the court has a lighting system. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes remaining. When the red light comes on, your given time within that period has elapsed, and you need to look to the court to continue, if you would. And we've also recently installed an audio recording system. And so the arguments today will be recorded by audio. You can go online and listen to how strange your voice sounds. Should be posted on the court's website within 24 hours or so. By way of housekeeping, that one guy in the crowd, if you have a cell phone or other device you need to turn off at this point, that would be good. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Ms. McIntosh, how are you this morning?
Good, how are you?
Good. Ms. Thompson, good to see you.
Very good to see you.
I was hoping we might get to hear you argue.
I'm sitting second here.
Yes, ma'am.
Your Honors, this case involves a rare set of circumstances and a very narrow question of law. In this case, a state agency eliminated one political subdivision and forced another political subdivision to take on its territory. The question presented here is, under these specific circumstances and under this statute, what statute governs who is responsible for the unemployment benefits paid to the workers who used to work for the now eliminated political subdivision? Is it the Unemployment Compensation Act's provisions that govern what happens when a private business voluntarily acquires another private business, and that even governs when one political subdivision voluntarily merges with another political subdivision? Or is it the specific statute at issue here that governs the forced annexation and allows the forced annexation? As far as we know, Chapter 13 of the Texas Education Code is the only statutory provision that allows the state to close one subdivision and require another one to take over its territory and provide services to its citizens. The purpose behind the statute is clear. The entire state benefits from an educated public. And that's why we have a public education system in the first place. And that's why every single inch of the state is in at least one public school district. If a public school district isn't doing its job, the state has to be able to close that school district down. But in order to ensure those kids are still educated, it has to be able to force them to go to another school district or force another school district to educate them.
Is there anything in the course of that having happened over the years where there's something that tells us whether that second school district is considered a successor? Because it seems like part of their argument requires them to put you guys into the box of being a successor to North Forest.
There is no other, this is a new question of law. Nobody's ever decided this before, and there's nothing in the statute that says you are or are not a successor. However, what the statute does do is two things. First of all, it limits what can be assigned to the successor school district. Remember, the purpose of this is to make sure these kids are being educated well. So when the statute says, okay, when the legislature says, okay, commissioner, you can close this school district and require this other school district to take them on, they also put into place provisions to ensure that that second school district could be successful. The first of these is a requirement that the commissioner conduct what they call an annexation study. In other words, he has to look at the financial obligations of the school district that is receiving it, in this case Houston ISD, look at their financial obligations, look at their financial placement, and make sure that school district can, with the money that it's going to receive, educate all of its students, all of the new students we're going to be giving them, and meet all of their financial obligations that they already have. When they do this, they look at the things that are due and owing at that moment. They look at the debt that must be paid that is already due and owing from the closing school district. They do not and cannot look at future contingent obligations. We have an affidavit in the record from the Texas Education Agency's former general counsel, who was the general counsel at the time this annexation study was conducted. It's in the clerk's record at page 223. And he indicates that the Texas Education Agency did not consider unemployment compensation benefits and could not because it had no idea how much was going to be paid out because that money, that amount is not known and it's not doable and owed by the school district until, because it's a reimbursing employer, it's not owed until the money is paid out. And we didn't know how many people were going to get other jobs and how many people were going to be receiving unemployment benefits.
Workforce seems to go to great lengths to go ahead and somehow prove that this was not a future contingent obligation, but that it was already set. Is your best argument against that sort of the difference between a reimbursing employer and a normal private employer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Explain that to us, if you would.
Okay. So they base their argument on Wilburn, a case decided by this court. And in that case, the court determined that a taxing employer, which I'm not getting the right word, I'm not getting that word right, but a normal business employer who pays an unemployment compensation tax, pays that tax based on the amount of salary they pay out, wages paid out, and the tax rate for that year. That's an amount they know at the beginning of the year. They know what the tax rate is. And the moment they pay those wages, they know what those wages are. And that is the instant that they become liable for that tax rate, right? Because we have the amount, you paid it out. Whether you keep paying them for the rest of the quarter or you fire them, it doesn't matter. You still owe unemployment tax on that at the end of the quarter. And we know that the minute that income is paid. That's the decision that Wilburn made. But that does not apply in the case of a reimbursing employer. For a reimbursing employer, they only owe the state money when benefits are paid. So you cannot determine what that amount is until the benefits are paid. But not only that, you can't determine if something's ever going to be owed until the benefits are paid. What if that employee got another job? What if that employee has already reached their lifetime benefits? What if that employee cannot meet the eligibility requirements for unemployment compensation benefits? There's no way of knowing if that person will ever require benefits or if that school district will ever owe money until the benefits are paid. So under the reasoning of Wilburn, it's the payment of benefits that triggers the liability for a reimburser
so
employer.
When you have this sort of equity argument about, well, gee, if no one pays these, the state's stuck with them, is it different under a private employer who's paying the tax as you go along versus a reimbursing employer because it's a risk sharing, or what's the difference there?
There's two differences. First of all, it's true that this is part of the reason, right, that private employers have to pay as they go along and pay based on wages because you never know when they're going to go bankrupt and what's going to happen. And so you need them to pay as they go along to pay against the risk that their future employees won't be there. As a general rule, there's not a high risk that a political subdivision is going to shut down and that suddenly they're going to terminate all of their employees. And in this case, neither North Forest ISD nor Houston ISD played any part in that decision. It was actually the state who terminated all of its employees and shut down the political subdivision. And so that's why the state as a whole should bear the responsibility for this. It also should bear the responsibility because the state as a whole gets the benefit from Houston ISD educating these students. If the state as a whole didn't get any benefit from it, there would be no reason to have this statute.
I guess if we're talking equities, though, on who should pay, I mean, don't you guys now have under your umbrella the taxable entities or the people within the taxing district that would have incurred this or caused all this?
Yes,
to begin
we with? Have the we have the tax. We have that property tax or that property, and that property can be taxed. Two things. First of all, that money has to go to actually educate the new students who are there in the school. It's not there to pay for terminating, to pay for $3.8 million in unemployment benefits. There's not that extra money in the budget.
Is there a specific statutory provision you rely on that, or is that just kind of common sense?
It's just common sense that, it's common sense, first of all. And second of all, it's in that annexation study when they look at they look at the revenue that the new combined district will receive, and TEA actually determined that Houston ISD received less money after the annexation than the two districts received separately. So the only way for HISD to even meet its current obligations and educate these new students is by saving money through equities, right, through cost efficiencies and the cost effectiveness of having a larger district. But even that doesn't take into consideration that these are students who were attending a failing school district, failing schools in a failing school district for years, and you have to bring those students up to, you have to do remedial education and get them up to par. There are so many expenses. The expenses available, the expenses associated with operating North Forest ISD remained the same or went up at best remained the same. Yet Houston ISD didn't get an extra $3.8 million to pay for this Workforce Commission bill that came 6 months after the annexation.
But let me ask this. Is it your position that maintenance and operation taxes can never be used to reimburse unemployment debt?
No, absolutely not. It is under the law. It can be used to pay unemployment debt. It's the only thing that can be used. The interest and sinking fund tax cannot be used to pay unemployment debt.
So is your answer that, you know, we can't pay because the money's not there, or we shouldn't have to pay from that bucket if there were money there because we didn't terminate these employees?
It's both, actually. The first one is that we didn't terminate these employees. They were never our employees. And this money is not based on their employment with Houston ISD. It's based on their employment with a completely different subdivision. And first of all, that's our first argument. And the second argument is more that to the question of why doesn't this additional property tax allow you to pay for this unemployment debt, I would say that additional property tax is only enough to allow us to educate those students. There is no extra money there. At no point in its history did North Forest ISD pay $3.8 million in unemployment debt in 1 year. The only reason there's $3.8 million worth of unemployment debt is because the state terminated all of its employees. In a regular school year, North Forest would have been paying a significantly smaller amount. And that amount Houston ISD can take on as it takes on those schools and begins to educate those students. But this additional money associated with terminating all those teachers is outside of the normal range. I'd also point out that a decision that says that a school district is required to pay this unemployment debt when another school district is closed and annexed onto it forces that school district into an untenable choice, especially when it's two smaller districts, which has happened in the state in the past, where the school districts are closer in size to each other. It forces them to choose between keeping the teachers who were keeping all the employees, not just the teachers, the administrators who were running that unsuccessful school district, and paying this unemployment debt and taking that money away from educating its students.
If they hadn't kept them all, would it be more tenable for HISD to then carry the unemployment?
It would, but it would be untenable in a different way, because it would be impossible to turn around or not. Yes, it would be impossible to turn around those schools, right? You have a structure in place with a failing school where something has gone wrong in that structure. Whether it's the teachers, the principals, the superintendent, somewhere in that structure, something has gone wrong because it was failing year after year after year after year. If you want to turn around that school, we know that you have to put in new personnel. In fact, the few teachers that Houston ISD did hire from North Forest ISD, it specifically put in non-North Forest ISD schools and put different teachers in those North Forest ISD schools because it wanted to make sure there was a change of culture and a change in how these kids were being educated to make sure they could be educated successfully.
But you don't dispute that the unemployment should have been paid by someone, whether it's HISD or the state or the private sector. You're not disputing the underlying claims that they were paid.
We can't, because we were never given the bills in time to contest it. Well, we weren't given the bills until after it was already paid.
Well, I guess my question is it your position that no one should have paid, you know, no one should have paid this unemployment, or that someone should have paid it, just not
Our position is that the unemployment payments should have gone to these teachers who were terminated by the state, but that it is not HISD's responsibility to reimburse the state for paying the unemployment benefits for teachers the state fired.
And HISD came in after the process would have given them the ability to challenge that, even had they wanted to.
Yes, the bills continued to be sent to North Forest ISD's agent, and HISD did not receive them until several months after the annexation was finalized. But more importantly, I think that the key here is that these are for benefits paid out after the annexation. In terms of benefits that were paid out prior to the annexation, HISD did pay those debts. But the statute in question that governs the annexation and that even allows the state to require Houston ISD to take on this territory, or require Houston ISD to take on any of North Forest ISD's debt, specifically limits that debt to debt that was due and owing on the date of annexation, and more specifically to bonded indebtedness, which this certainly is not.
So did Houston ISD pay some unemployment claims on, I guess, on or before the date that
yes.
everything was annexed?
They paid all of North Forest ISD's, they reimbursed the state for any claims that North Forest ISD owed that were due and owing before the annexation date.
Okay. And then on this going back to this reimbursing employer, isn't that just an inherent risk in being a reimbursing employer that you don't know what future unemployment claims you might have to pay, right? And so that's a kind of a gamble that you take, is like not knowing, because you could get the certainty of paying quarterly, right?
Right. That's true. But you take on that uncertainty of paying for your employees, not for employees that you never hired and that you did not fire, right? You take on that risk because you don't know when you might terminate your employee, and you don't know whether the employee you terminated might file for benefits. You do not take on that risk for a completely different political subdivision terminating its employees, much less the state terminating all of that political subdivision's employees and then requiring you to take on that subdivision's land. Right. This is just a very unique situation, and it's not the normal risk that a reimbursing employer takes on.
Would your arguments be any different if Houston was involved in the process and agreed to take on North Forest?
If Houston ISD voluntarily took on North Forest ISD, yes, absolutely. Our position would be completely different.
Okay. What was your perception as to why, was it Judge Jenkins that did the summary judgment? What was your perception as to why the trial court granted summary judgment?
I can't presume he without any sort of opinion that tells me what his order was based on.
Okay. Maybe an unfair question. So.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Ms. McIntosh. Morning, Mr. Ryan.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. North Forest was shut down by the state on July 1st, 2013, and annexed by appellant. As a result of the annexation, appellant acquired substantially all of North Forest assets. Under 204.086 of the Labor Code, appellant is therefore liable for any debt North Forest owed TWC at the time the acquisition occurred. There are really two issues in this appeal. First is whether the term indebted, as used in 204.086, includes debt that is contingent and unliquidated when an acquisition occurs. Trial court correctly found that 204.086 applies to contingent and unliquidated debt. Second issue in this appeal is whether Chapter 13 of the Education Code exempts school districts from successor liability under 204.086. The trial court correctly found that Chapter 13 has no effect on reimbursement debt arising under the Labor Code. There are really four main points we'd like to emphasize today. One is that appellant's construction of 204.086 would defeat legislative intent and violate federal law. Two is that Chapter 13 of the Education Code has no effect on reimbursement debt arising under the Labor Code. Three is that when North Forest terminated all of its employees as of July 1st, 2013, it immediately incurred an unliquidated debt to TWC for all benefits that would later be paid to the terminated employees. And four, when TWC later paid benefits to these individuals, TWC fixed the amount of North Forest debt, but TWC did not create the debt. And our first point is that appellant's construction of 204.086 would defeat legislative intent and violate federal law. And appellant essentially argues that 204.086 does not apply to contingent and unliquidated debt. The problem with that argument is that the legislature went to the trouble of enacting a statute which provides that reimbursing employers are subject to successor liability just as private employers are. And that statute is 205.016 sub 3 of the Labor Code. Because of that statute, 204.086 must be construed in a manner that gives effect to the legislature's clearly expressed intent to impose successor liability on reimbursing employers.
But Mr. Ryan, can you come up with any other parallel in the private sector where this would happen, where a business would be required to take on another business without really having a say in that decision?
Off of the top of my head, Your Honor, I cannot. I think the key point is that the legislature has chosen to impose this successor liability statute on reimbursing employers. The voluntariness of the acquisition, we believe, is irrelevant. This court has interpreted the term acquires as used in the Texas Unemployment Compensation Act, and that was in the Ben Hogan case. And this court sort of applied a plain meaning analysis and says that the term acquires is construed broadly as to gain by any means, to gain or receive in whatever manner. And so we believe that this, by the plain language of the statute, when North Forest acquired, when Appellant acquired North Forest assets, substantially all of those assets, they acquired North Forest debt. And it's just a straight plain language analysis.
What do you think about the distinction they make about Chapter 13, how it used to say, what was it, obligations, contracts, and indebtedness, and then those first two words were dropped and it later became indebtedness, sort of that distinction?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess our first response would be if Chapter 13 used to apply to a broader range of debts, that enactment has since been amended. And I think Appellant concedes, and this is an important point, is that when Chapter 13 uses the term indebtedness, it refers only to bond debt and not to any other type of debt. So we really don't think that there's any basis for Chapter 13 to be construed to exempt school districts from successor liability. And
so just because it mentions bond debt doesn't mean it's addressing all debt or saying that's the only debt.
Yeah, not only that, but Appellants concede that the term indebtedness refers only to bond debt and not to any other type of debt. And so, you know, if the legislature had intended to establish a comprehensive scheme governing every type of debt a school district might have, Chapter 13 would be an odd way to express that intent, because both parties agree that it refers only to one specific type of debt. And if the legislature had intended to make such a significant policy change regarding the Texas Unemployment Compensation Act, you would expect to find some explicit mention of that either in Chapter 13 or in the Texas Unemployment Compensation Act. But there's really no such statement to that effect in either enactment.
Is there any pattern of practice you can look to on how they handled other debts? Like, what if they had food services debt, or, you know, sports equipment debt, or stadium lights? I guess stadium lights gets into facilities, but what about just ongoing accounts and vendor type issues? How do those get handled?
Yes, Your Honor, that's an excellent question. That was something that occurred to me as we were looking at this case, but I'm not really aware of other debts and how what the law is governing on school district, you know, undertaking contract debts or other debts just in the general course of business. We're just focused on the statutory scheme at issue here, reimbursement debt arising under the labor code, and it's the labor code that governs sort of how that debt is handled in terms of successor liability issues and the like. And we do want to emphasize so we think it's pretty clear, because the legislature enacted the statute imposing successor liability on reimbursing employers, the court has to construe it in a manner that gives effect to that legislative intent. The other key issue is that the Texas Unemployment Compensation Act, or TUCA, is a joint federal-state program, and Texas is required to administer that program in accordance with federal law. And if Texas fails to do so, it jeopardizes hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding that Texas receives each year to administer TUCA, as well as billions of dollars in federal tax credits for Texas employers. So Texas employers get a tax credit on their federal unemployment tax, but only if they're paying into a state system that's been approved by the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor actually reviews all state court decisions interpreting TUCA to ensure that the program is being administered in accordance with federal law. And we want to emphasize to the court the key provision in federal law here is UIPL 2180, and that was issued by the Department of Labor, and it states that a reimbursing employer, quote, must always fully reimburse the state for benefits paid to its former employees. And we think this federal guidance makes very clear.
What do the feds say about successors in this specific fact scenario we have?
I'm not aware of any specific guidance on the successor liability issue, but the key point that we take from 2180, Your Honor, is that because that guidance makes clear that when the acquisition occurred, North Forest was liable for all benefits that would later be paid to the terminated employees. Because North Forest was liable for those benefits when the acquisition occurred, appellant is also liable as a successor under 204.086. So that's the significance, we believe.
Where does the definition of successor that we're using here come from? Where do we look to? And then who bore the burden in the trial court of showing that HISD is actually a successor? Is that an issue here, or does everybody agree that they are?
Well, as in any tax case, the taxpayer seeking a refund bears the burden of proving it is entitled to a refund. And appellant conceded during discovery, which is included in the record, that it acquired substantially all of North Forest assets. And that is the trigger for successor liability under 204.086 of the Labor Code. So there's not a definition of a successor. There's just 204.086 that says when one employer acquires substantially all of the assets of another employer, that acquiring employer becomes liable for any debts that the predecessor owed at the time the acquisition occurred. And I don't believe that appellants are contesting that per se, and I'm not aware of any argument to that effect they made below. And so we just want to clarify that under appellant's construction, North Forest would only be liable for the tiny fraction of reimbursement debt that was fixed and liquidated when the acquisition occurred. That was about $12,000. And then under that logic, appellant's liability as a successor would also be limited to that tiny fraction as well. The result would be that over 99% of North Forest reimbursement debt would not be paid by any reimbursing employer. And that result would violate federal law. And we believe this court should reject any construction that leads to that result. And sort of on a related note, we think
what would happen in the federal law if that amount ended up having to be paid by the state or some wing of TEA or whatever vast trove of money sits over there?
If the money was paid by the state or some other entity? Well, I mean, the federal guidance says the reimbursing employer must always fully reimburse the state. So I guess I don't know how the feds would feel if someone else was stepping into the shoes of the reimbursing employer and paying that on their behalf. I it would be hard for me to speculate. I suppose maybe, you know, as long as the money's being paid and not dumped on the private sector, and perhaps the feds would be okay with that. And that is the key point here. The reason the feds have issued a regulation saying the reimbursing employer must always fully reimburse is because that prevents the reimbursement debt from being dumped on the private sector. If the court adopts appellant's construction, that $3.8 million is effectively dumped on the private sector, and this is because only private employers are subject to the tax rates, which TWC adjusts each year to ensure that the unemployment trust fund remains solvent. So this sort of dumping of reimbursement debt on the private sector is exactly what the legislature sought to avoid when they enacted a statute saying that reimbursing employers shall be subject to successor liability, just as private employers are.
But doesn't Section 13054G, when it's talking about, listen, if a school district is an academically unacceptable school district, is bonded into another school district, you know, if there's too much debt, at least on the bond side, the state is willing to come in and help them out of that hole, why wouldn't the state be willing to do the same thing for unemployment debt?
Well, when you say the state, I think we would want to be careful because the money in the unemployment trust fund is not the state's money. That is held in trust for the future class of qualified recipients of unemployment benefits. That is not general revenue that the state can spend, that the legislature can appropriate. The state is simply a trustee. And in fact, we're barred by law from settling unemployment tax cases for just that reason, because it's not our money. And so that would be the key distinction. My other response would sort of dovetail into Chief Justice Rose's question, which would be if someone else paid it, you know, I'm not sure what, it's hard for me to speculate what the feds would do in that situation, but it's very clear that money cannot be paid for out of the trust fund, because that would, the key point here is that reimbursing employers are supposed to pay in dollar for dollar for all of the money that goes out of the trust fund for benefits issued to their former employees. And our a couple other sort of our final two points focus a bit more on the timing issue. When did North Forest incur its debt to TWC? And the trial court found that when North Forest terminated all of its employees on July 1st, 2013, it immediately became liable to TWC for any benefits that would later be paid to the terminated employees.
Is that a fact finding or a legal finding?
No, Your Honor. It was just, they granted our summary judgment, and that was the basis for our summary judgment. It was basically two arguments that 204.086 applies and that Chapter 13 has no effect on successor liability under 204.086. And we believe that one of the key principles of law that supports the trial court's conclusion is the continued liability provision in 205.015 of the Labor Code. And that provision states that a reimbursing employer must reimburse TWC for benefits paid to its former employees, quote, even if the employer is no longer a reimbursing employer when the benefits are paid. And that application in this case is very clear. North Forest was a reimbursing employer until it ceased to exist on July 1st, 2013. After that date, the terminated employees received benefits based on their prior service with North Forest. Even though North Forest was no longer a reimbursing employer when those benefits were paid, North Forest was liable for that debt under 205.015 because the benefits were based on the recipient's prior employment with North Forest. And so the analysis sort of looks back to what are these benefits tied to, and it sort of extends liability beyond and sort of makes it essentially relate back to the time the termination occurred. And so we think 205.015 really confirms that reimbursement debt is created and incurred prior to the actual payment of benefits by TWC. And it is true that when North Forest terminated its employees, it was not yet known whether they would receive benefits or what the total amount of benefits might be. But this simply means that North Forest debt was contingent and unliquidated when the acquisition occurs. Does not mean the debt did not exist. Contingent and unliquidated debts are still debts. Black's Law Dictionary defines a contingent debt as, quote, a debt that is not presently fixed but may become fixed in the future with the occurrence of some event, in this case, the payment of unemployment benefits by TWC. Black's Law Dictionary defines an unliquidated debt as, quote, a debt that has not been reduced to a specific amount. Numerous Texas courts have also held that debts are created and incurred are created and incurred prior to liquidation of the debt amount. So, for example, contract debts are created and incurred the moment a contract is executed, even though the resulting debt does not get reduced to a specific amount until some later point in time. That's the Willis, Bonamore, and Superventures cases cited in our brief.
Are these type of things contingent, though, or are they contingent on some violation of the employment agreement?
In the case of contract debt?
No, in the case of TWC benefits.
Their reimbursement debt is contingent on the terminated employee later filing a claim for benefits, qualifying for benefits, and receiving those benefits.
And between the termination and the filing, doesn't there also have to be some sort of a, you know, some factors that are met, you know, that they don't find further employment or those type things?
Exactly.
And so that doesn't affect the fact that these are unliquidated damages that are incurred at the time of the contract?
No, and we think that continued liability provision in 205.015 really clarifies that, as that you're liable for any benefits paid to your former employees, even if you're no longer a reimbursing employer when the benefits are paid. And we also believe that if you, as I mentioned earlier, if you construe the statute to exclude contingent and unliquidated debt, it would remove virtually all reimbursement debt from the reach of the statute. Because reimbursement debt is always going to be contingent and unliquidated when an acquisition takes place. And so that would, such a construction would render moot the legislature's clearly expressed intent to impose successor liability on reimbursing employers by enacting 205.016 sub 3, which says reimbursing employers are subject to successor liability under 204.086, just like private employers are. And so we believe that the cases, Willis, Bonamore, Superventures, also those are contract cases. Same is true with tort debts. Texas courts have held that a tort debt is created and incurred the moment a party acts negligently, even though the resulting debt is not liquidated until later, and that's the Hovel versus Botstreet case. And so we believe that these authorities confirm that the term indebted, as used in 204.086, includes debts that are contingent and unliquidated when an acquisition occurred. And the last point we wanted to make was that when TWC paid benefits to the terminated employees after the acquisition, TWC fixed the amount of North Forest debt, but TWC did not create the debt. And appellant argues that North Forest $3.8 million debt did not exist until TWC actually paid benefits to the terminated employees, but that argument confuses the initial creation of a debt with the subsequent liquidation of the debt amount, and that distinction was made very clear in Willis, Bonamore, Superventures, and Hovel versus Botsery. Another problem with the appellant's argument is that it assumes that a creditor such as TWC can unilaterally create a debt without some initial triggering act by the debtor. And appellants don't cite any authority for that claim, but in each of the three or the four cases we mentioned, the debt at issue was created by an act of the debtor. So the debtor either executed a contract, which created a contract debt, or the debtor acted negligently, which created a tort debt. Subsequent acts of the creditor may affect the amount of that debt. For example, when a contract creditor mitigates its damages after a breach, but those later acts of the creditor do not create the debt itself. Only the debtor can do that. And we believe the same principle applies to debts owed to TWC. The agency cannot unilaterally create debt out of thin air. There must
But Mr. Ryan, what did HISD do to create the debt?
They acquired substantially all of HISD, I guess we would take a step back. North Forest created the debt by terminating all of its employees. They immediately became liable for that debt. HISD, and I think what HISD's argument is that that debt didn't exist until TWC paid benefits. And we think the law is very clear that North Forest was always on the hook for all those benefits the minute that they terminated their employees. And so that was when North Forest incurred the debt. And then appellant became liable for that debt the moment that they acquired substantially all of North Forest assets under 204086.
And would you agree that NFISD was forced to fire their employees by a decision of the Texas Education Commission?
Yes, yes. And we do believe there's some support in the case law for the analogy to private employers. So in Wilburn, this court found that a tax debt to TWC is created by an act of the employer by paying wages to the to its employees, creating a tax debt under the labor code. It was not created by a later act of TWC, such as sending them a bill or adjusting their tax rates due to subsequent benefit claim decisions in court or what have you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Thank you.
Ms. McIntosh, y'all aren't saying that TWC created the debt, are you?
We are not saying TWC created the debt. We are saying that the debt was created by a combination of factors, but it didn't become final until the state, until the employee established that they were eligible for the benefits and applied for the benefits and received the benefits. I would also say that part of this, they rely a lot on federal law. And on this argument that the federal law somehow requires the state to assign this debt to Houston ISD, and that is completely untrue based even just on the guidance that they cite. They cite subparagraph A, which talks about how a reimbursing employer must always fully reimburse the state for amounts of benefits paid which are attributable to service and the employee of such an employer. They completely ignore the very next paragraph, which says whether benefits are paid or attributable to service in the employee of a reimbursing employer is a matter to be determined by state law. That guidance attaches an administrative decision that looked at whether a particular state's law that determined when an employer was liable for debts incurred by a subsequent employer was attributable to the prior employee. So just the exact opposite of what we have here. And they determined that what the state did is fine. They made a perfectly valid decision to determine when this employer was responsible for that subsequent, for the service and the employee of a subsequent employer. And they acknowledged that that will vary from state to state. There's absolutely no reason to believe that the federal government would decide differently here, where the question is, how does the state determine when an employer is liable for service attributable to someone in the service of a prior employer as opposed to a subsequent employer.
Are there any disputed fact issues here, either in this successor question or in the attributable to the employment question?
I do not believe there are any, well, I don't believe there are any fact questions. I think it really comes down to which statute controls. And if there's a conflict of law, which we believe there is, that these two statutes have different purposes, but and that Chapter 13 has this very comprehensive scheme for what can and cannot be assigned to Houston ISD. And the way it works, you know, the state's argument is, well, they didn't specifically say you can't be assigned this debt. But the fact is they did by taking out that term obligations and that term contracts. There is law out there that says that a school district is not responsible for the contractual obligations that continue on. You asked about this in the context of other obligations. There's both a state administrative decision, which is contained in our appendix, and a decision by the Texas Education Agency Commissioner saying that a school district, an annexing district, is not responsible for the continuing obligations and contracts of the prior school district, and also two lawsuits that were dismissed by North Forest ISD teachers, one by state court and one by federal court, when the teachers were arguing that Houston ISD was responsible for their contracts.
And do those limit it to bonded indebtedness, as Chapter 13, as you argue Chapter 13 does?
Yes, I don't know if they actually talk about bonded indebtedness in the commissioner's opinion, which is the only one that explains its reasoning, but he does specifically say not responsible for contracts and obligations. And our argument is that if Chapter 13 controls, then what matters is what debt is assigned under Chapter 13. It doesn't matter what the definition of debt is under the labor code. And it's quite possible. It's often the case that words mean one thing in one code or statute and something else in another. Even if the Workforce Commission's provisions normally consider and include unliquidated contingent future obligations as debt, that does not mean that the Education Code does. There is no other authority outside of Chapter 13 to even allow the state to require Houston ISD to take on this school district and take on any of its debt. So there's absolutely no reason to say that the legislature would have, when doing that, said, oh, but you can't force them to take on this debt. Because the fact is, without an authorization to force them to take on debt, you can't force them to take on debt. And it's absolutely not true. We are not saying that under the labor code, that a subsequent employer is never responsible for this unemployment debt. We're saying under these specific circumstances, they're not.
Under these specific circumstances, did the payments come out of the fund that TWC maintains for, like, non-reimbursing employees?
I believe it would, because it would be service that was not attributable to Houston ISD. So it can't come out of Houston ISD's fund. But honestly, how the state pays for it is up to the state. The state's the one who chose to terminate the employees, and the state's the one who paid the unemployment benefits. So the state can be the ones to figure out how to pay for that unemployment reimbursement debt.
Thank you both for a well-argued case. You've got quite a conundrum there. We'll do our best to figure it out. Case will be submitted. Court will stand in recess.